Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith for this Friday the 17th of November, coming to you from a very busy Grafton Street in the centre of Dublin City, where Christmas is very much present. In the shops with window displays, Christmas music coming from many doors and the Christmas lights overhead. But next Friday, Friday the 24th of November, is Black Friday.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
Call Black Friday because, according to the retailers, it's the day they actually go into the black for the very first time. But on a day when we'll also apparently spend millions, ironically, online. Well, somebody with a different perspective on Black Friday is Martina Lehan Sheehan, who's an author and psychotherapist and is with me here on Grafton Street. Martina, you have a different perspective on this particular Black Friday.
Yes, I have, Michael. I suppose it's something I've been thinking about for a while, and it really emerged in a book that I've just been exploring and researching, What Brings Happiness. And it came from all of that, really.
So, Christmas is about presents and gifts and happiness and buying things.
Yeah, and we all enjoy it. Absolutely, we all enjoy it. But people also say it brings a lot of anxiety, it brings a lot of competition and keeping up with the Joneses, and all of that comes with it, even though it can be inherently enjoyable.
Let's look at a little bit of the psychology about that for a moment, because I would have thought that's a kind of an endorphin release when we buy something and it makes us feel good. You've got a different idea about that.
There certainly, it's mood altering. You're absolutely right. But it's actually more an adrenaline rush, and an adrenaline rush changes very quickly to depletion. Whereas, yes, we produce the happy hormones and, as you said, the endorphins through things like exercise, hobbies, relationships, all of those more lasting things. And the shopping, yes, it gives a great buzz and we all like it, but it's a quite short one. It's actually an adrenaline rush which drops, and we get back to what's called our happiness set point very, very quickly afterwards, very quickly.
Now, we look around us here in Grafton Street, we can see a lot of people actually looking a little bit anxious about the whole shopping process itself. You have an idea called Bright Friday.
Yes, I'm getting anxious now to hear that people are anxious already. So Bright Friday, the whole idea of it came about, Michael, when Curragh Press, the publishers of my new book, were asking me, would I have an idea for launching it? And I was saying, well, the theme of the book is about cultivating another way, a way of cultivating your own happiness, really, through a journey that you take. And I said, why not create an event on what is the most busiest day of the year, when cars are bumper to bumper and people are jostling, craving for something to fill that space. And that is the perfect, I suppose, opportunity, if you can use it that word, to look at what really does fill that space.
So you're going to take us now across the green to the UCD Church, and we'll find out about some of the things you've planned for next Friday here on Stephen's Green. So, Martina, we've crossed Stephen's Green and we're here in the Newman Church, UCD Church off Stephen's Green. And you know what? You're absolutely right. It's so quiet.
Yeah, and I suppose that's a metaphor, really, Michael, for what we're trying to do on Bright Friday, is that we're right in the middle of a busy street, and people's lives are busy and people's minds are busy, and we have to create a little sanctuary that we can return to in ourselves and take that journey.
And your choice of a venue like this church, does that suggest that there's a spiritual component to this Bright Friday?
Indeed. When I suggested the idea of Bright Friday to Curragh Press, they suggested this venue for that very reason, that it's right in the middle of the marketplace, so to speak. So there's a spiritual dimension to that, you know, that we find our stillness, we find our God, or however you want to phrase that, in the middle of our marketplace.
And if people do put down the shopping bags long enough next Friday, what will happen and when will it happen?
Yeah, so if people come in here with their shopping bags, it is on between 1 and 7. Now, during the day, there'll be various music, poetry, atmosphere created and that. Between 6 and 7, the theme that we were just discussing, you know, become who you are meant to be, which is also the theme of the book, the psychology of happiness, how to find stillness. I'll be giving a talk on that, helping people to find stillness
in the middle of all of this rushing, and there'll be a guided meditation and so on. I suppose it's based a lot, really, Michael, on what, you know, modern psychology calls the science of well-being, that no matter what we buy and no matter what we own, apparently we can't raise our happiness beyond about 10%. Whereas the we call it the 40% solution is what we cultivate from inside, a way of being, a way of seeing, attitude and so on. You know, so that's what we're trying to nourish on Bright Friday.
Martina Lehan Sheehan, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
And you can find out more information on the event Bright Friday, which takes place this day week in University Church, Stephen's Green in Dublin. And you'll find the information on our programme webpage at rte.ie/radio1/The Leap of Faith. Martina's book is called Surprised by Fire, Become Who You Are Meant to Be, and was launched earlier today in Cork City, and all royalties are going to Chernobyl Children International. Well, the contrast between blackness and brightness continues this weekend as we witness the struggle between these two extreme forces in a new two-part Would You Believe series on RTE television this Sunday, which deconstructs the nature of evil.
It is a force that is totally alien to God and to love. It's pure darkness.
When my daughter was murdered, I came across the murderer. He was pure evil.
They do no right from wrong. They just disregard that.
The last face of evil is the psychopath. They're sadistic, they're antisocial, and they're paranoid, so that makes them dangerous.
To tell us more, the presenter of the programme, Mick Pilo, joins us. Mick, welcome to The Leap of Faith. There's a personal twist in this story for you. 23 years ago or so, you were involved in a documentary. Tell us more.
Yes, I was doing a Would You Believe about the supernatural, and I was trying to find an exorcist to talk to about the programme. I found it quite difficult, but a particular exorcist who didn't want to be known put me in touch with a group of people who performed exorcisms that he had trained. And so I went and witnessed one of those exorcisms. And what I found that day, that evening, just frightened the hell out of me. I mean, I wasn't expecting what I saw, which was what seemed to be a demonic kind of voice coming out of a woman that was not of her. It just frightened me. And I've never, ever found a satisfactory explanation as to what that voice was. And so, in a way, that's what started this, to find out, well, what is evil? Is evil human or is it supernatural? What is it?
Now, in the programme, it's in two parts. It's very up to date. I mean, over that 23 years, you don't have to go back too far to find examples of what we would describe as being evil, including mass shootings in the United States, for example. What was the approach that you took? Did you look to see, was this scientific, psychological, or supernatural?
Well, since those in that 23 years, I'd made more programmes about the supernatural or the other world or, again, on exorcism. And I had met another exorcist, who Father Pat Collins, who had said to me, look, really what you need to do is we need to look at this from a multidisciplinary approach. You need to be talking to psychologists, psychiatrists, neurologists, theologists, theologians, and can we all put our heads together and try and find out what the hell this thing is? And so it was from that, in a way, I said, okay, well, let's look at this question of evil. What is it? And let's look at it through the disciplines of science, behavioural sciences, psychology, psychiatry. I also looked at criminology and the sociology of evil, and then theology, the different religious and different faiths' view of evil.
Okay, well, let's explore this a little bit more. You head off into a university where they've got brain scanners and they've got neurologists. What do they tell you?
Well, before I went there, I went to a family who had been the victims of what they would call evil. And they, you know, and naturally, when somebody is a victim of murder, well, their family are have been a victim of murder. I went to the Callalys, where Rose and Jim Callaly spoke about them, their daughter, Rachel, who was murdered by her husband, Joe O'Reilly. People might remember back then, it was about 12 years ago. They maintained then that Joe O'Reilly was evil, which is understandable. That's what we would all think, he's evil. But, you know, most of us think, well, yes, that's what you would say, wouldn't you? But looking back, maybe he's not evil. What he did was evil, you know. hopefully he will, understand what he's done is wrong, pay his price to society. That's what you think. But 12 years later, they're saying, no, he's pure evil.
When I realised who done it, like a person that she had trusted with her life, that we trusted with their life, and the mother of his two children, and to know then afterwards that it was planned, well, I don't think you could do anything like that and have a conscience. I don't honestly think he has a conscience. And I don't, like, when you look into his eyes, there's nothing there.
He's empty, with nothing inside him. As if he was just a tin box with nothing in it.
Like, that has to be evil.
And so, they go into detail as the characteristics that made him evil and why evil was in him and how it was in him. Not why, but how it was in him and how that manifested itself. And that was kind of frightening. And that led me to the psychotherapist, Christine Louise de Canlemille, who'd written two books on evil, one called The Three Faces of Evil, to ask her, well, are people evil? And she says, well, people are evil based on a whole approach to narcissism. You've got the narcissist, the malignant narcissist, which she says is quintessentially evil, and then there's the psychopath, the most dangerous of all. And their evil is can be callous, can be they've no conscience, they have no empathy. And she describes in psychological terms what the Callades have just described in their own understanding, what they think is evil. And so I'm going, are people evil then? And is it a miswiring in the brain? That brought me to the brain scans and the neuroscientist who says, well, she looks and says, well, it is in the brain because we're wired, human beings are wired to empathy, to sort of empathize with other people's
pain. To feel other people's pain, for example.
And when we see images that are hurtful or we see people being hurt, we naturally empathize with them. And something goes off in our brains in a place called the amygdala, which I never knew about before, or the insula. It's the spot in your brain that something goes off in us. And well, I'm saying us because I'm saying we're not evil, but it goes off in the normal person that says, they're empathizing with those people, with those people's pain. But in the psychopath, in the studies of them with psychopath, that part of the brain doesn't go off at all. That doesn't respond. They don't have empathy for other people's pain. And so that made me think, well, is there such a, can we see that evil spot then? Can we actually work on that? And why is it there? Who put it there? How did it get there? What causes
that? Has it a function?
Yeah.
Yeah, what does it do?
And so that led me to the next stage, to look at psychiatry and to look at criminology. The criminology, when I went to UCC, the professor of criminology, Colin Sumner, and fascinating. I think he's the only course I know of that does a module in criminology on the sociology of evil. What he sees as evil is a moral censure. It's like what people call see as morally outrageous as evil.
Because this could actually happen across history. What people did 200 years ago in the name of anything, faith, religion, or their country, might have been considered to be an honourable thing to do at the time. It was a heroic thing to do. Now we would look at it and go, that's evil.
Yeah.
So if...
Yes, one person's evil could be another person's heroism, and that's what he was saying. And I think that's an understanding we got. And the other thing I think, which is really important that I suppose I knew instinctively, but at the same time I wasn't sure about, was, we tend to project and say those people are evil because they did horrendous, horrible, harmful things to other people. Yes, that's true. But if we stand back and look at the circumstances, we have to, some way we have to own that too as part of who we are. Now, not as part of McPilo, yes, but as part of me, but as part of the society we live in, the circumstances, the environment. What created those circumstances, situations where people did those things to other people?
Let's talk about the devil. Right? The devil's in the detail and some say the devil is dead. If he didn't exist, would we invent him? Do we need this personification of evil in order to make us feel better?
Yes. That was the second programme is an exploration of the devil, this figure of the devil, because he's there in many. Well, I thought he was there in every religion, to be honest. That's what I thought, and I'm working in religion a long time, and I thought, well, most religions have devil, don't they? But actually they don't. And to discover that was it was interesting. So I looked at Hinduism, I looked at Islam, Judaism, and you know, to find that they have the same character, Shaitan, Satan, or whatever it is, Satan, whatever they call him,
by any
other name, but he's not the devil that we know in the Christian faith, which is the sort of that malignant force that can possess you and cause you to do harm to other people. In Judaism, it's fascinating that they say, you know, he's an agent, an angel and an agent of God. God is, you know, and you sort of say, what? Evil is an agent of God, Satan? And yes, you know, because the rabbi tells a story, it's a great story. The man comes to the rabbi and he says, Rabbi, get rid of this, pray for me to get rid of this evil in me, this evil inclination that I have to do all these horrible things. And the rabbi says, I'm not going to pray for you to get rid of that, because if I get rid of that, life wouldn't be worth living. And it's interesting that's an integral part of who we are as human beings. And so we need it in order to try and be good people.
Have you been in the face of real evil?
Personally, I thought I was that day 23 years ago. I thought I saw and heard the face of evil, because I saw a woman's face distort, change, her eyes look demonic. I heard a voice come out of her that wasn't of hers. And I thought that was the time I was at the devil. Was that? Is this something beyond me? That's the nearest thing. I mean, I tell you, if I was near the Las Vegas shootings, I suppose I'd be saying yes, I'd be right in the centre of evil, or the Sutherland Springs shootings. I'd say the same thing recently. But or the earthquake in Iran, for instance, is evil. But there's different levels of evil. You know, there's the moral evil. There's natural evil. I started with a sort of a pursuit, in a way, to find out, well, was that voice I heard is evil? Was that demonic? Was that the devil? And I think I found the answer to that, but you're going to have to watch the programme to find out.
Mick, it's very easy for us to get very intellectual when we start talking about this subject, but there's a huge amount of emotion attached to this too, and even particularly for one man, Father Pat Collins.
Well, Father Pat Collins is an extraordinary man. And I've worked with him and made television programs with him over the years. And he's one of the few priests I know who will talk about evil in a way that the church believes it to be, a devil, the force, a malignant force that is outside yourself that can actually possess you. To my mind, he's an exorcist. He's formally probably not an exorcist, but he's performed exorcisms. He has seen the face of evil, he says. So he's taking it very, very seriously, and he gets very annoyed at the church's attitude to it. So I asked him a question in the programme about, you know, why is the church so reluctant to talk about this? I've formally asked the Catholic Church for an exorcist, and they haven't come forward. And he gets quite annoyed about it.
I'm about to say is not going to be popular with the church, but it appalls me that we have no safeguarding from the evil spirits. I say that in the sense that we don't train anybody to deal with these cases. Priests, it's not that they don't care, but they don't know enough about it. Dioceses, and I say the book has to land on the bishop's desk. Who have you trained in your diocese? And I'd say to bishops, woe to you that neglect the spiritual care of the people.
It bothers you?
Oh, deeply.
Yeah.
The first thing Jesus said when he was sending out the apostles, the very first, I wish the bishops would listen to this. These are the signs of power that will be given to believers. In my name, they will drive out evil spirits. How many bishops, in accordance with Canon 1172, have trained anybody or appointed anybody in the Diocese of Ireland to help our poor, unfortunate people who are oppressed and sometimes possessed by these awful spirits? They've abandoned the sheep.
Father Pat Collins there, that's fighting talk.
Yes, it sure is. And I suppose, you know, he has a point. He has a point to make. But I suppose to throw it on the bishops is one thing. There is certainly a reticence among many clergy to talk about evil today. And again, we explore that in the programme. Peter Stanford, the former editor of the Catholic Herald, deals with that, I think, in the programme very well. Why is there such a reluctance among Catholic clergy in particular to talk about evil? The interesting thing is, Michael, about this is Church of Ireland very recently has appointed 3 of its members to be exorcists, if you like, and has trained 3 priests to work in this field, to specialise in this field. And they hadn't much of a problem to talk to us, but they weren't prepared to talk to us on camera because they weren't available. One of them wasn't available anyway. But it's interesting that they're not afraid to talk about it, but the Catholic Church is.
And I'd just like to put a little extra insight into this as well, that in many of the exorcism requests or exorcism situations, actually a psychosis has been identified rather than an evil spirit. Would that be the case?
Absolutely. I think this is the point. And that's one of the things I would have liked to have explored a lot more. Most cases that present themselves as being possessions, if you like, and needing exorcism, turn out to be, and Father Pat Collins will be the first to say, turn out to be psychosis, psychiatric problems. But you'd be naive to rule out that there might be a malignant force that is possessing the person there. That's what he says.
And the programme is a Would You Believe special. In fact, there are two on evil, Sunday at 25 to 11 on RTE1 television. Mick Pilo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Finally this evening, when you think of a high-rolling investor, you might think of someone in global markets making high-value decisions, investing in millions, maybe billions of dollars. What you might not think of are religious groups dealing in trillions. A few weeks ago, more than 30 different faith traditions came together in Zug in Switzerland to develop ethical guidelines for their funds. Earlier, I spoke to Martin Palmer, Secretary General of the Alliance of Religions and Conservation, and asked him to define what is a faith-consistent investment.
All the major religions of the world fund their schools, their hospitals, their social welfare, their buildings, their clergy, their printing presses, their television stations, even their radio stations, through investments. And one of the problems has been that these investments have often been handed over to management groups and finance groups who do their best, you know, they raise as much money as possible for the faith, but there has grown to be a discrepancy between what the money is used for, the wonderful works of religions around the world, and how it's been gained, very often from oil companies or from exploitative groups or from groups who don't pay a living wage and so forth. And so what this is about is saying, in order to earn money to do good, that money should be invested in good things. In other words, how your money is raised must be consistent with what you're then going to use it for.
People are initially surprised when they see the actual amounts of money that we're talking about. This isn't something from the piggy bank. We're talking about major funds.
Yes, we are probably talking of at least 10% of the total capital market of the world is owned by major religions. And it's very, very difficult to accurately estimate because nobody's entirely sure how much wealth there is out there. But I think it would be quite safe to say it is probably around about $10 trillion worth of assets owned by the major faiths. And on top of that, it's estimated that you can times that by three, somewhere in the region of $30 trillion worth of money, which is of investments, which is owned by people who are people of faith, lay people, families who are of faith. So we are probably talking of something like 40% of the total capital investment market of the world has been, can be, and now, by the grace of God, will be influenced by religion.
A lot of the religions would have, as part of their charism or as part of their belief, a concept of poverty and charity. How does that square with high-level finance?
I mean, one of the great problems for faiths has been being honest about money. And I don't mean that they're dishonest with their money, but particularly if we take Christianity, we've got that teaching, you know, you can't serve both God and mammon. And actually, the faiths have tried to do both. So there is a certain embarrassment. In a certain way, we've sort of brought into the daylight finance officers who many religions would be quite happy to keep in the basement. Because in the end, the ability to sustain for 100, 500, 1,000, 2,000 years, hospitals, schools, social welfare and care, some of the most stunning and most important buildings in the world, architecturally, spiritually, cannot be maintained by what people put in the collection plate on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or whatever it is. Faiths, in a sense, have always had to find a way to earn money to do the good that they do. Our problem has been that we've not been honest about that, and therefore the money has been sort of hidden away in corners. The investments have not been really looked at too closely. And then when they are looked at closely, as has happened for my own church, the Church of England, at times we've been profoundly embarrassed by what has been revealed as to where we've put our money. And for the first time ever, the faiths have actually sat down, and we've had eight faiths here, from Buddhism through to the Shinto of Japan, via the Taoist of China, and many different Christian groups, and Hindu, and Sikh, and Jewish, and so forth. For the first time, you can actually say, what am I supposed to do with my money as a Christian or a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Jew? And what, therefore, should I expect my religious structures, my churches and mosques, to do with that money? This has never been done before. They've done negative screening. They've said, you know, we're against alcohol or against pornography or against military, you know, against armaments. But they've never, never before said what they are for. And now this means we can hold them to account. And they want to have a tally kept. They want to be kept to these commitments. And in fact, so much do they want to be kept to this commitment, they've decided to create a whole alliance in collaboration with the UN, the Vatican is joining, with many of the secular agencies like WWF and groups, saying, let's actually work together, not just religions, but the great philanthropies of the world, along with the great institutions. Let's direct our money into actually investing in the kind of world we want to build.
The United Nations have come full in behind this particular strategy with you.
They have indeed. And not only did we have the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, Elliot Harris, speaking powerfully about how the faiths could become one of the greatest movers and shakers in helping the UN with its sustainable development goals, its environmental goals. But to our amazement, and I have to say that as the person who chaired this, on the very last day, the UN actually stepped forward and said, we want to set up a whole section within the UN that will work with the faiths, and it will actually become a department of the United Nations. It's incredibly exciting, to be frank.
Martin Palmer of the Alliance of Religions and Conservation, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith. And details of tonight's programme are on our webpage, rte.ie/radio1/The Leap of Faith. From all of us here, good night.